Welcome to clause indexing in this lecture on virtual machines. So last time we kind of considered that as a useful optimization in order to restrict backtracking. So we would like, instead of creating a backtrack point, listing all possible alternatives, we would kind of restrict ourselves to the sublist of clauses which match, which are only eligible, if you like, given that the first actual parameter starts with the constructor A. Yeah? And if this list of clauses consists of a single element, then given that the constructor, the topmost constructor of the first argument is A, then we would have a deterministic decision which of the different clauses to choose, and no backtracking has to occur at that particular, at this particular predicate for the given literal. And that is kind of a useful feature to limit, to, since a backtrack point kind of has to be allocated on the stack and remains on the stack for a long, for a potentially long time. So avoiding a backtrack point is always a good idea because it allows to pop the stack earlier and by that be much more space efficient. And therefore we would like to do that. So let us consider, so we consider our standard example, the app append predicate, here it is. So how do we kind of, so what was our idea? So the idea was to check the actual parameter for the first argument. And we assume that, and that we would like, if we have static information about that, or if we have information, if we can retrieve some information from that, we would like to choose the deterministically a subset of clauses. So here we see corresponding to the first argument, we have here a unification goal. And the right-hand side is a term, and the term has a topmost constructor. And so that means the first clause can only be selected if X starts with the empty, with the constructor empty list, okay, and after empty list is an atom, so nothing is below. And the second clause is only selected if the first argument X starts with a cons, and then otherwise it is not selected. And then there's only a third, and if there is a if a constructor arrives in the, as an actual parameter for the X, which is neither the empty list nor nor the non-empty list, like some other, since it's untyped, it could be any other constructor, then this predicate will fail. Okay? And then there's only one situation which we also must take care of, and that is if the app predicate is called with a literal, in a literal where the X, the first argument, is unbound, is an unbound variable, then we have no possibility to check at runtime, because it's unbound, whether the first or the second clause must be selected, and this is the only situation where backtracking must occur. So therefore, we would kind of separate, in this case, so the idea is to separate the list of, to make sublists of the clauses for each of the possible constructors for the for this first argument. So there would be a sublist for the empty list, a sublist for cons. Then for any other root constructor, there would be an empty sublist, and that is a kind of, for that we introduce a particular instruction which is fail. And the implementation of fail is simply to call backtrack. Yeah, because all in all other cases, the clause will fail. And then there is kind of a catch-all or fallback solution when the first argument is an unbound variable. Then both we must be able to iterate through both alternatives when we search for a solution. So, accordingly, we will now no longer construct a unified dry chain, but a different dry chain for taking this extra information into account. So this is, that means a separate dry chain for each possible constructor. And, so that would be kind of a collection of dry chains. And then the implementation would do the following. It inspects when the implementation of the predicate would check the first argument. If it finds a particular root constructor, then one of the dry chains is selected. If it finds an unbound variable, all clauses must be tried. But for that, we also provide a separate dry chain. Yeah? So this means, depending on the result, we can then perform an index jump to the appropriate specialized dry chain, which only takes care of a subset of clauses. Yeah. So let us assume that four clauses R1 to RM. We have this collection of tri chains. It is now a collection, and you see by that, since the code for each clause exists only once, while trying a clause could occur in several tri chains. In particular, if a clause does not inspect the root constructor of the first argument, then case distinction on the first argument will not be able to rule out this clause. So this means that this clause must be taken care of in all tri chains for all constructors in the first argument. So in that sense, it's not distinct, but an overlapping collection of tri chains which we construct. But in each tri chain, for each alternative, we only have this instruction try, or the immediate jump if it is the last alternative. But these kind of try instructions are duplicated in this collection of try chains, but the code for the different alternatives occurs only once. Yeah, and is jumped to from different try chains. So that is the idea. Assume that we have this collection of try chains, then this which we can build up statically by inspecting the clauses and the unification goals in the right hand sides of the bodies of the clauses referring to the first argument, if there are any. If there are none, then as I said, this particular clause must be included into all tri chains. So here, for example, let us look at our particular situation. What kind of tri chains would we construct for the up? So there is for the append predicate, so there would be one tri chain for nil. So since there is only one clause for that, we do not have to install a backtrack point. We directly jump to the corresponding alternative. In case of cons, there is also no try chain because there's only one alternative. We directly jump to the corresponding clause. And then there is the case that there is another constructor is found, which is different from nil and cons, and then we immediately fail. And then there's only for the case that the actual parameter, first parameter, is an unbound variable that we have to execute the try chain which we have considered last time, which considers both alternatives. So only in this case a backtrack point must be created. Yeah, and then following this 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 collection of tri chains come at A1 and A2, the code for the two alternatives. Yeah, so fail is backtrack. I told you about that. So in that sense, this failing is a very simple instruction. Now, in general comes the code for a predicate. It looks the predicate P with K arguments. How does it look like? It consists, as before, of the code for the alternatives. It incorporates the tri-chains to jump to these serialize kind of an overlapping subset of potential possible alternatives, and then additionally has something to inspect the first before going into the tri-chains. You first have to inspect the root node of the first argument, and depending on that node, we will access the right tri-chain. And this is done by these kind of three instructions. So the first one kind of takes the first argument. So this is a put ref. So it pushes a reference, the first argument on top of the stack. Then we have to inspect the content of that. And this we do, for example, we could provide us with an instruction get node, which kind of takes the tag, and which is either atom A or struct F, N or reference to something. Yeah, these are the things which we obtain by this get node instruction, and then we kind of do an indexed jump, and the indexing depends on the current predicate, therefore it is kind of index pk, and I will kind of tell you in a second why pk must be handed over to this index function, and why we cannot use this jump I which we had for C. I will come back to that in a minute. So the first thing is, before that, let us check for the get node. So the get node thing kind of is like the get basic in a functional language, so that is in principle what we kind of need here. It just takes the name of the constructor or the name of the atom and puts it on top of the stack. And then there is this, in case we have an unbound reference, it just also has to put something on top of the stack, and that is kind of R, for example, assuming that R is different from all atoms and constructors, and this is guaranteed here since R is in capital letters, and by a namespace argument, constructors are small, are not with capital but with small letters. Okay, so that is kind of what the get node does. So it does not change the height of the stack, but replaces the reference with the content. Okay, now comes the index. Indexing in this Prolog language is a little bit complicated. Why? Because it is untyped. So we do have no information that we really have a list. So there could be, we could call the up-predicate with any constructor in our system. So, and assume that your Prolog program is large, even if you kind of have your own idea in mind that a list data structure uses only cons and nil, and a tree data structure uses only constructor tree. At least in principle, the compiler cannot exclude that this tree constructor will arrive here. So therefore, it must be prepared for all constructors in the system. So this is the drawback of an untyped language, that you have to provide preventions for all kind of weird things which could happen. So, and that means anything can happen, and so we kind of have to map anything to something to the corresponding tri-chain. And that the simplest way how we can do it is just using a hash table. So we have to realize this mapping. Most of the constructors simply will be mapped to fail, and the others to this dry chain consisting of fail alone. And the others, the few others, will kind of point to something meaningful. Yeah. And so this kind of mapping depends on the predicate, because every predicate has its own tri chain, and therefore index depends on the predicate, because you have to select the right hash map. So therefore, this index. So once again, the indexing takes the label on top of the stack and uses it to return the corresponding address in the of the particular tri chain within the bunch of tri chains provided for a predicate, and then jumps to it. So, and that is kind of the instruction here. Okay? And so that means, in particular, this means that the runtime system of Prolog must provide these hash maps. But as we have kind of very expensive other runtime functions, providing a hash map for is only a marginal extra overhead. Okay? And, yeah. One could even think of it that one uses the just one single hash map by using the pair of predicate and constructor as an index. So by that one can join all kind of all hash maps into one. Okay. So that was the indexing, and as you saw, it was not so complicated. The only thing is that we had to arrange the tri chains into many tri chain, one tri chain into several tri chains, decompose it into several tri chains, but each of them is shorter, and so that is better. So otherwise, there was not so big a complication here. And it was also, there's also another kind of philosophical idea which goes into this clause indexing, and that is you try to exploit what you know as much as possible information available from the code. And information available from the code are the constructors occurring in the topmost constructors occurring in unification statements for the first argument. So that is, and this principle to exploit static information about the code to make better code, this is what compiling is about. Okay, so now let's go a little bit further and make our implementation more realistic. And in the beginning, I said, okay, we kind of stick with the pure Prolog things and leave out the cut. And leaving, so the cut operator is bad, is from hell, if you like, since it destroys the logical semantics of Prolog. The logical semantics, yeah, so that is you have implications, you have a literal, you want to prove it. And then kind of what the Prolog interpreter would do is find a proof. And if it returns a proof, everything is fine. But it could be that there is a proof, but Prolog will not find it. Why? Because it searches in the wrong direction. For example, it always tries the first clause, and the first clause will kind of it does depth first search for a proof. And now the depth first search, if the recursive case comes before the non-recursive case, then you kind of may have an infinite descent and never never try the other alternative. So there could be proofs which are not found by Prolog. So this is kind of... No, it will not fail because it will not terminate. You cannot. If you could wait for in eternity, then in eternity, at doomsday, so to speak, you could say, "Aha! This alternative will not provide me any solution. I try the other alternative." But that is only at doomsday. and not before. And so that is not a practical solution. So failing by non-termination is no possibility. No, you cannot check an occurrence if it doesn't terminate. Occur check is something else. Occur check checks in a in unifications, but here it's not about unification, it is about recursion. And you could have the same query a second time, and that's fine, and a third time, and that's fine, and only at the fourth time it terminates, or it will never terminate. So that makes the undecidability of first-order predicate logic. So therefore, it is in principle impossible to write a complete interpreter. So that's kind of, but it's this is how, in some sense, this is how life is, and we kind of for practical programming people therefore have the cut operator. The cut operator allows to prune the search space. And as soon as we have the cut operator, even the attempt to understand Prolog as a logical language will fail. Because the cut simply does kind of prunes at will the search space. So you find something or you find nothing. So if you find something, okay, then you have found something. But if you... That's typically not to understand that in a logical sense is perhaps a little bit sometimes not so clear what that really means. So, but operationally, the semantics here is the operational semantics of what the cut should do. So consider this one. You want to kind of do realize such a thing like an if-then-else. So every meaningful programming language which we had so far had an if-then-else. So if you write down an if-then-else, here maybe this one, this P is the condition. And I kind of cancel out the cut operator. What would happen? What would be the case? So P, you would query the predicate P. If it holds, okay, then you proceed and try alternative Q1. Okay, so that is like the if-then. But now what happens if the Q1 fails? Well, the condition was true, so this branch should be taken. You should not continue with the else part, only because a fail occurred later on in the then part. Yeah. So therefore, you should not continue with the Q2. Yeah, that would be what backtracking gives you, but you would kind of say this branch predicate has failed. The then you had to decide for the then part, and now this then part failed. So then the whole branching failed, and you should kind of proceed upward. And for that, in order to have this natural, to realize such a natural implementation of an if then else, you need the cut. So what is the cut? So here is the cut. So I think some of you told me that showed up at least indicated that they have written a little bit of Prolog program. Who has used the cut? So you use the cut. Did have you a clear understanding what it does? Yes. Yes. So this is kind of this means once you have, as you said, once I have reached this point within this clause, I will not return to this to the given, neither to the. I will not reprove this one. And when this and a kind of. When I fail here, I will fail with a branch. Yeah? Because I kind of... So this means I will not... So that means two things. The first thing is I will not return here, and I will not return here.
So the Q2 is number 1.
the Q2. Once I have traversed, I have crossed the cut, I will never try the Q2.
But if I try the Q2 first...
No, you will not try it first, because there's a sequential ordering. You always try the first loss and then the second one. Okay? So it is not... This indicates, even if there is nothing here, the cut could make sense at the beginning of an alternative. This means always try the first alternative, and once you have done that, you give up the backtrack point. Okay, so how can we deal with that? The idea is, as soon as we are, how do we implement it? Since we will not at the cut, we will not return here, we will not return there. At this branch thing, this is the current stack frame. There we have stored an old backtrack pointer. And that will become the new backtrack pointer when we are beyond the cut. This is the implementational idea. Yeah? So we restore the old backtrack pointer of the current stack frame. And that means that all the backtrack points which have kind of been pushed on top of the stack above the current stack frame, they can be popped, because they do not contain all backtrack points which are stored there are discarded. Yeah. So this is this second thing. So by that, this cut operator, if you place it, it kind of shrinks the stack, and that is good, because it kind of space consumption is from hell. Okay. So that is, in this sense, we translate the cut operator in two instructions using this prune thing. I may make it in a different color so that we can distinguish it from the red part. Prune, which is a new instruction, which kind of restores the backtrack pointer, and then popping all the stack frames. How can we pop all the stack frames? Well, there's an easy way how to do it. We kind of make a push env here, which sets the stack pointer to frame pointer plus m, if m is is the number of locals. But that the top of stack is kind of goes down dramatically and blows off all the stack frames on top of it. So let us see. So that is the implementation of the cut. You see, it's very simple. It's just these two instructions, of which one we already know. The only new one is this pruning. And we can therefore kind of check what that, well, and again, even if we have not yet defined this, what that pruning would do, we can generate code. And here is the code for this if then else. So we kind of, so this is, this branching is a two clause predicate. This is implemented by means of a tri-chain. Here is the corresponding tri-chain. A is the start address of the first, and B is the start address of the second clause. For the first clause, we have a piece of code which kind of corresponds to the P of X. First we push the environment, which is you make push env 2, because there are two variables around for the first clause. Then, yeah, so that I should kind of indicate in a separate color. So this is this push env thing. Then comes the code for the first literal. And there is the variable x, which is a second occurrence of x, therefore a putref 1. And that's it. Now comes the cut, and the cut here is this prune followed by push env 2, because branch has two actual parameters. And no, sorry, because the first clause has two formulas, that's true, but there's no further variables. If there were further variables, say 20 altogether, then we would have a pushenv 20. But so, in this case, only pushenv 2. And then comes the last literal, which in this case is the last literal of the clause. So therefore, we have a last mark. Then we put the two arguments, x and y, which is a putref 1 and a putref 2, and then a last call for the q1, for the predicate q1, since two locals are squeezed out of the stack, it is a last call q1/2 and 2. Yeah, so the second 2 is the number of locals which are squeezed out of the stack. Okay, so that was the code for the first clause. Now for the second clause. So by the way, since due to the pruning, no backtrack, we are for sure that no backtrack point is on the stack anymore, and branch also is no longer a backtrack point, we could remove this last call completely, last mark completely, and replace this last calling through with a move and a jump. But if we are unaware of such kind of extra considerations, we could also put this last mark and this last call. Now comes the code for the second clause, and that is very conventional, because the second clause is jumped to if there is only kind of accessed. Yeah, it's jumped to only if the predicate P failed. And so in that sense, this is just an ordinary clause, but a clause which is the last clause, and also containing a single literal. And since there is no literal to the left, we are sure that there will be no backtrack point before. So therefore, we don't need a marking. We can use the same stack frame for this recursive call, and we could do a jump in the end. So therefore, we have this jump here, and no marking or last marking in the beginning. And so the only thing after pushing env 2, doing push env 2, we only kind of put the two arguments, and then move them down by 2. And I see here now it's as usual. I have showed that several times, and I immediately see that here's a mistake. There are too many twos, so this is a putref 1. Because x is x. Yeah? Sorry. So there should be a putref 1. Okay? Is there a question? Here it is, the putref 1. And here, interesting, so here it is wrong, and here it is corrected. And you see here, since the due to the pruning, and I have optimized here away this last marking and this last calling. Okay. So you see, in that case, the only situation where we have to create a new stack frame here in this case is when we for the P, but we do not need a new stack frame for the Q1 or the Q2. Okay. Now, after this little exercise, let's look at what the pruning should do. And now we said this pruning just restores, so it's very simple, we just restores makes the current backtrack point the old backtrack point. So this is, we simply remove this thing here into the BP, and that's it. So this means the current stack frame is no longer so there is no backtrack point here. Okay? Good. Now there is only one problem. So if pruning restores the backtrack point, the old backtrack point, what is the case if the clause where the cut occurs in is single? So we have kind of something like a predicate single, X, and then you have a PX QX. So what should be the semantic? So this is also a semantic definition. In some sense, then all backtrack points in the P should also be given up, and the current backtrack point should be the backtrack point which was active before the single. How do we find it? Because this is stored. So if P installs a backtrack point or provides new backtrack points, then we kind of have to traverse these kind of the old backtrack pointer backwards until we find something which is below the single. That is kind of a stupid thing to do because it's kind of chasing old backtrack pointers, and that is kind of not nice. So, and it could also be the case that P does not even store a single backtrack point because it's also a deterministic predicate. We would kind of take, nothing has to happen because the old backtrack pointer would then be also the new backtrack pointer. So, in this sense, the idea is we would not like to do a separate treatment for single clauses. And this is important also for that reason that what does it mean for a clause to be single? So actually, the same clause could occur in several try chains. It could occur in one try chain where it is single, because it is there because of the constructors occurring there. But it could also occur in another try chain where it is not single. So what can we do? So the idea, therefore, is not to have a separate treatment or to change the code of a clause, but to change the code of the tri-chains. So to modify the tri-chains in such a way that when the tri-chain is a single element, then we kind of, and a cut occurs in there, then we we kind of explicitly set the backtrack point, also it would be otherwise not necessary. And this is, for that we kind of provide us with a new instruction, which is the set cut instruction. And this set cut instruction only stores stores the current BTP stores the current BTP as the old BTP in the stack frame. So it doesn't store all the other things because one will not return here in this, if one calls this instruction set cut. This is a situation where one would not return to this stack frame for backtracking, but only kind of uses this particular pointer this particular reference to a backtrack point as the one to restore the old backtrack point. Yeah. So in this sense, it's a simplified version of this setBTP instruction. We could use the setBTP, but why should we do it? Because neither the heap pointer nor the trail pointer must be stored here. Need to be stored in the stack frame. Okay. So now let us see whether there is a situation where we have, yeah, no, I think this is just an, I have no example where this set cut really is used. But it is simply you kind of insert it into the corresponding try chain at the beginning of the try chain where you only have one alternative, where the next one is kind of a jump. Okay, so the, instead of try comes a jump. Okay, so now let us see, look at one final example in this, to where we try this cut operator, because the cut operator enables some form of negation. And that is also something which we was not available in our pure logical mini sub-dialect of Prolog. We could not say, if something does not hold, then do something. Because if something does not hold, it fails, and then you do something completely else, but you cannot kind of... So this negation is difficult to achieve. And that is kind of... So if we kind of have this cut thing, then we can kind of implement something like negation. And here is this negation by failure. So assume you have a predicate P. And you want the predicate not P to succeed whenever P fails. How can you do it? Yeah. So assume P succeeds. So then here, so this is here the implementation of that. So assume then for the, what is the semantics here? So you call your query not P. So if you start with the first clause. So the first clause tries to prove P. If it succeeds with P, then it executes the cut. And then there is some specific literal in Prolog, which is this fail literal. And the fail literal is kind of you can implement it by means of a predicate without clause. So it fails always. Yeah, it is not provable. So it gives. So this means once you have successfully proven P for X, then the first clause fails. But the backtrack point of the whole clause is of the not P is kind of given up. Cut, fail. Now I'm a little bit confused. Because at least this one, you should go to the next alternative. So, but I said the old BTP. I wonder whether I kind of explained it right with this pruning. Once it fails here, but then I said it continues here. But that is kind of what the not P should do. Yes. So, once again, yeah, no, I think it's true. So if this failing, so if it fails, so that is, so I was confused, sorry for that. I confused myself. So here, if it fails, then this not P will fail. So it will not try the second alternative, because the backtrack point installed for the literal not P has already been given up. So this simply fails. So this means if P succeeds, the not P will fail. So this is the negation. Now what happens if P X fails? Yeah. So if backtracking is installed for the P of X, so the proof of P could not be for X could not be successfully terminated, but it unsuccessfully terminates. What then happens? Then you have not reached. Then you fail somehow before the cut, and that means you. The backtrack point for the not P is still there. And that means you try the second alternative and that consistently succeeds. So if P fails, then not P will succeed and return X. And otherwise, it will fail. So that's kind of negation by failure. Yeah? And that's kind of, so you could implement for everybody, so with, and you see here, the if you had no cut there and you just placed the fail in the end, then the second alternative would be tried and that would always succeed. Yeah? So that means if P of X succeeds, then the second alternative would be tried and it succeeds. And if P of X fails, then the second alternative would be tried and it succeeds. So it would always succeed. So in that sense, it would be a useless. Without cut, this is not meaningful. But with cut, it is meaningful. So in that sense, this negation by fail, this is a phenomenon which you can only achieve if you have the cut. And now clearly, this not, in real prologue, not is not, there is kind of, it's an auxiliary function. In that sense, you can write not P of X and use that as a literal. So, but you see by that, the not is a meta predicate which takes a literal as its argument. And here in this lecture, we have no meta predicates. So therefore, therefore we would have to implement this one, and this meta predicate somehow is a generic, is implemented by means of a generic version of this, the code which we generate, which we would generate here for that particular pair of clauses. So let's see how we would kind of implement now by means of the cut and the fail, how we would implement this pair of clauses. And so the first thing, it is a pair of clauses defining this predicate, and therefore we have a tri-chain. So this is this two clause tri-chain with a setting a BTP, trying one alternative, deleting the backtrack point and jumping to the second. Then comes the code for the first. For the first alternative, it starts with this push-env and then with a code for the literal P of X. So this is here. And the argument you see is a putref 1 because X is already initialized. So now comes the following that comes the implementation of the cut. The implementation of the cut is this prune followed by a push env 1. Clearly this push env 1 is in that sense, so this X is no longer necessary, actually, because of the fail. We could also directly call the fail. So this push end one is kind of redundant because we this failing calls the backtracking, and that kind of will blow off the stack pointer, the stack anyway. And then afterwards comes we have reached the end of the end of the clause. There is a pop env, but clearly this pop env also is redundant because we failed before. After a fail, you can kind of remove all other instructions, but I placed them, all these other, both the push env 1 and the pop env, I placed them there because these are generated by our code generator. And then that is the first alternative, and the second alternative is has an empty body. So empty body is also very simple, because this means just we push, we have a push env 1 followed by a pop env. Okay? So by that, and that is kind of the final example, and in some sense the one with a with one with an intricate semantics, if you like. And perhaps you see this is a two clause something, so the semantics is a little bit difficult to explain already. And that kind of gives an indication why even medium-sized prolog programs are much harder to understand than functional programs, and perhaps even much harder to understand than imperative programs, because the control flow is subtle, to say the least. Okay, so then maybe we kind of so that is now the point where we kind of have finished the implementation of Prolog, and it's time for questions if you have some. Otherwise, I would kind of add a little discussion of a key essential both of functional programs as functional languages as well as Prolog, and also of Java. So all these languages provide us with the luxury of a garbage collector. And I don't know how many people of you are expert C++ programmers. Once again, no expert C++, expert C programmer. But you have all programmed a little bit in C or in C++. So then you know when you have to kind of track or keep track of your own memory. This is a cumbersome thing, and it is very easy to make mistakes, which are very difficult to hunt down, because a pointer points somewhere, and perhaps you have freed already that area. So this is a very subtle bug, in particular, if you want to kind of avoid to waste of memory, you may feel tempted to do everything by kind of passing around pointers, and actually in C++ it's very encouraged even by the type system to have these reference types and these things, not to copy or dynamically to allocate objects, but to put them on the stack and pushing around the references. But then, for some reason, such a reference is still there, but the variable has already been popped off the stack, and then suddenly you have dangling pointers and things like that. So there are so these are kind of a big nuisance, and garbage collection is a cute invention if it works. And if one is used to it, one does not like to miss it, I would say. And which makes Java programmers typically bad C++ programmers. I hope that this is not insulting to you, but it also applies to me to a certain degree. Yeah, it also applies to me. But now, how can we do this garbage collection thing? Then we should kind of discuss a little bit how garbage collectors work in principle. These are kind of what I show you now will be kind of the most trivial garbage collectors. There are perhaps even more trivial ones, but they are not, they are completely useless. These are viable garbage collectors. But the efficient garbage collectors look differently. So there are even more and sophisticated garbage collectors, which I will not discuss here. But they are a topic of their own. So once again, what is the idea? So we always speak only about we allocate a new object in the heap and we pass around references, we dereference and so on. And we do not say something about what happens if an object in the heap is no longer reachable. And then we expect the garbage collector to free. And that is to somehow inspect the memory and kind of so allowing us to reuse memory. Otherwise, we would very quickly hit the memory barrier, and that is we could not... memory is full, exhausted, we cannot proceed. Because there's perhaps one more stupid thing, but perhaps, which is also perhaps an experience not so frequent perhaps to Java programmers, but much more frequent to functional programmers, that your heap increases if you allocate more and more memory. And at some point, it kind of starts swapping. So that means it kind of the virtual memory space is still there, but it's only possible by means of by swapping to a background memory, and this swapping then makes slows down program execution so much that essentially there is no progress anymore. So then you can simply kill your program. For Java programs, it's not so frequent, but for functional programming, this is a very bad experience. And if the garbage collector is able to collect memory quickly, then perhaps swapping can be avoided. Yeah. So we would like to free memory space, which is no longer accessible by the program. So that's the idea. And accessible, so that means now the question is, what does it mean to be accessible? So, and that is clearly, if you have a language like C, you can do pointer arithmetic. And so by pointer arithmetic, in principle, you can access a lot of much more memory as if you had direct pointers to something. On the other hand, so in that sense, pointer memory garbage collection in C is more difficult than in other languages, and therefore it is not typically not provided by C. It's also the case that you never know in C whether something is a pointer or whether it is an int. You could cast it to an int, and then later cast it back to a pointer and then access some memory. And in between, by casting it to an int, this memory is gone, and then you recast it, it's accessible again. So it's strange things which you can do in C. Okay, so that is, but in functional languages there is kind of not, a pointer is not an address, but it is a kind of an abstract data type, if you like. You cannot kind of change it, so it is just there. And you can identify it, and then you can follow it. Yeah. There's one extra caveat, which is also one of the reasons why I have this section here, is that the same garbage collector, which kind of would, that there is already some kind of garbage collection in the Prolog machine, and this is the garbage collection of failed alternatives, because there we pop the heap and kind of do this unbinding, and that kind of frees objects, and the heap usage shrinks. But beyond that is not sufficient. You also need garbage collection if there is no failing, just to remove unreachable objects in the heap. Yes. Okay. And therefore, let us see. And the interesting thing is that the garbage collection of the functional language looks a little bit different from the garbage collection for the Prolog machine, because the Prolog machine, for that we kind of have to be to kind of preserve the stack discipline on the heap. This makes the garbage collection, the potential garbage collectors for Prolog, more restrictive. So you cannot use any garbage collector, but only specific ones. Now, how does a garbage collector work in principle? So there are several ones, but in principle we will look here at stop and copy collectors. So this means you stop at some point program execution and then kind of try to recover that part of the heap which is really still in use. How can you do it? So the idea is that you kind of separate your memory into two. And then one is the from space, this is the old heap, and then you have a new space, which is the new heap. And then you traverse all objects in the from space, which are reachable, and move them to the to space. And clearly, each memory object is something, is a piece of data, is a block of data. You can copy it into the two space, but then this copied memory, piece of memory, contains references to the from space. So you have to later to readjust, and it contains references to other objects which also move. So you have to kind of correct these references so that afterwards they are correctly, objects in the two space correctly contain pointers which correctly point to the two space and not to the from space. Yeah. So this is this correction of references which is very important. And then you kind of can throw away the from space and just concentrate on the two space, this, which means you exchange the roles of two space and from space. Yeah. So that is kind of the idea. And now, this how do we? The one thing is, we have kind of to find out what one kind of subtask is to identify those objects which are reachable now, or which are still accessible from the program. And that is now, it's not, well, what are these? So that is, it's at least one has kind of to think a little bit to identify those live objects. So the first thing is clearly all references to heap objects which are on the stack make objects live. So if I have a reference from the stack to something, then this is a live object. Because later on I will kind of continue with the stack, I will access these references, and so I need these objects. So therefore I cannot throw them away. And clearly if I have a reference inside a live object, then I might look at these, and so therefore these are in principle also live. Yeah, and that kind of is already, this is a little bit problematic, because it could be, for example, think of these global vectors. We could we discussed optimizations where we said, instead of constructing a separate global vector for each expression, for five expressions, which I have to do for constructing the closures of a function call, I just take a superset containing all the globals and use this single vector three times. Now that is kind of a thing that there is kind of a live object, namely this global vector in the heap, but it contains references which are dead. And the similar thing occurs in Java. It could be that at a certain point in time, a certain components of an object are no longer used. Then at these components, these could contain a reference which is already dead, but it is still there, and the garbage collector does not know whether it is already dead. And so the object pointed to by this from this reference is still live, although it is from a program semantics point of view dead. So therefore, experienced Java programmers nullify attributes which are no longer required in objects to help the garbage collector to collect more objects. In that sense, this would kind of indicate that we should kind of be careful and try to construct as small global vectors as possible. And if I talking about Java, there are more things which are live. It's not only those which are pointed to by the stack. What other things are what could make an object live? There are thread objects, for example. So thread objects are, if the threads have been started, then the thread object itself need not be a reference from the stack. It is referenced from a running process. Yeah, so the running process knows its thread object. And you can retrieve it by current thread or something. Yeah, so that means there are other kind of data structures in your runtime system which contain references to live objects. So, for example, the ready queue or all the task queue or whatever kind of pools and threads, some things you have in your runtime system, they kind of point to thread objects which are live. And the same is if you think of if you have your window and your user interface containing frames and all these things. As soon as long as they are visible, they are live. Only if they are no longer visible and do not contain components which are visible or so, then they are dead. Yeah. So that means you have also the runtime system also maintains something which is visible on the screen, and that is also non-garbage. And only by switching something off and making it non-visible, if it then is not pointed at by some other things, then like a container, the surrounding container or something, then you have really, so if it's not visible and not pointed, then it is dead. So this means if you look, stupid to mention it, but you could easily make a mistake here. When you try to figure out what is live, you should look at all the resources of the runtime system and not just at the stack. Okay. And from these sources of liveness, you then do reachability. Okay, so let us here look at that particular memory. And here this is kind of a pointer from the stack. So we find the first object, which is live. We mark it, and from that we follow the references in here, and by that we find that this is also live, and this is live, and so these are the live objects. So those which are marked, and this one, which is not marked, this is dead. And please note that reachability checking is perhaps expensive, but if you think that after some time of program execution, you have perhaps 10% live objects and 90% garbage, then garbage is not visited at all. So the costs of garbage collection here are proportional to the number of live objects and not to the dead ones are ignored, never reached. Okay? So this is by that we have identified the live objects. So the next step is to copy from the from space to the to space. Now, how can we do it? I told you with the problem with the references. So we do it in that way that we kind of first copy and then at the same place where we copy, where we copy from, that is this situation here. This is the space where we have taken the object away and put it into the to space. There we leave kind of a forward address to the new to the new location. So this is like if you move and you kind of then tell your post office your new address, so that if a letter arrives at your old location, it could be forwarded to the new location. Because we have kind of copied the object together with its pointers, all the pointers go to the old space, to the from space. And that we do for all of the three objects. You see, all of them, now in the end, after this copying, their references point to some old locations, which are these forwarding addresses, and then now we can go through the to space. We can iterate here over these objects, and then see the references there, and then correct. Okay, so then we would kind of correct the references, and in the end, having done this correcting of references, now everything in the from space is garbage. The forward addresses are no longer needed. They are no longer accessed, addressed, because there are no pointers to them anymore. And besides of this kind of root nodes here, but then we kind of correct the root nodes in that sense that we correct the pointers to the stack in the stack. The pointers in the stack must also be corrected in that sense that they are the sources, not only in the stack, also in the runtime system, must be corrected in that sense that they do no longer point to the from space but to the to space. Okay. And then the to space is completely can be abandoned. Okay? So it's not complicated, but one has to, if you do the implementation of such a thing like this garbage collection, you better make no mistake. Because if you have a mistake in the garbage collector, then you would have very strange program behavior, very difficult to hunt down. And then you exchange this from space with the to space, and then you have simply program execution continues. And then now, what kind of passes did we have? We had I showed you one pass to do the reachability, one pass to do the copying, one pass to place the to correct the addresses. And clearly, this marking as reachable could, in placing a forward address, can be kind of merged with the copying into the to space. So that is kind of gives you one pass. And then the second pass is only required to correct the references. And now if you always point to an object which has already been moved, so you can directly copy. Correct the you can directly use the correct address. You do not need to insert an address into the from space, because you already know there is already this forwarding address, and you can kind of follow it and directly write the correct address. So in that sense, if you first copy the your referenced memory cells, and then only once you have done everything which is reachable from a node, you copy that node. By that, you kind of never need to do a correction. You always can write out the corrected references. That works fine if the code is the heap is acyclic. If it's not acyclic, because you have cyclic things in it, then this definitely does not work, because then at some point you have to copy something, and the referenced memory cells have not yet been copied. So, but that kind of could one do. These kind of cyclic structures perhaps are rare, and in that sense you could kind of use some kind of backpatching thing. You kind of keep a list of those objects which are which have not corrected references, and only patch them as soon as the corresponding objects have been moved. So there is kind of this could be considered as an optimization in that sense, as every object which is moved is only taken care of once and not visited several times. So this might be useful, and such a thing like garbage collection, which runs all the time, this should be you should use an utmost fast algorithm, so that you should not waste any individual step there. Whatever you can do quickly, you should do quickly. And also the algorithm to do this this garbage collection should be itself use a minimum amount of time, a space, because every space which the garbage collector uses cannot be used for program execution. So this is another requirement which makes practical garbage collection challenging. And overall, I told it already, but here I have stated it once more. The runtime of this garbage collector is proportional to the number of live objects. And perhaps I may make one comment. So consider, so the runtime, the garbage collector of Java is considered as less efficient as the garbage collector of OCaml. And you might wonder, what can you do beyond this reachability analysis and this copying to get a fast garbage collector? And the idea is to use generational garbage collection. You have heard of who has heard about generational garbage collection? So the idea is that in at least in functional programs, it is like that there are a lot of short-lived objects which are allocated and then immediately deallocated. So they are kind of for intermediate processing. And now generational garbage collection kind of subdivides the heap into sections, into kind of an old section and a new section. And these short-lived things kind of are in this new section. And when you kind of have small collections, then you only collect this new area. And only when there is kind of a congestion in this new area, you do a major collection. And since this new area is small, garbage collection there is fast. And it provides fresh memory, frees a lot of memory still. And so in that sense, you do many small collections and only few major collections. So by that you gain a lot. And that is this is the idea. And it works amazingly well. Yes? You mean reference counting?
Yeah.
You could use reference counting. This does not work with cyclic data structures. And in functional languages, you typically also have cyclic data structures. Therefore, their garbage reference counting is not considered as a good technique. Reference counting is used in these, if you have these smart pointers in C++, so this provides you with kind of an implicit reference counting if you want it. But it has the disadvantage that every pointer operation itself becomes expensive and you have the collection additionally. So this, in this sense, reference counting is an expensive form of garbage collection. And it has not, yeah. So at least this, in functional languages, people typically do not have reference counting. But in principle, it is one technique, and in some situations, it might be a useful one. Now, at some point I said, and here I repeat it once again, sorry that I always repeat, that the garbage collection for the Vim is more intricate in that we have two, since there are two ones, this one with a back for the backtracking and the other one if during unification, for example, you might allocate a little bit of extra memory which kind of gets lost later on. Or you build up an actual parameter of a clause and then later on you throw that actual parameter away. So these things happen, perhaps a little bit less frequent than in functional languages, but it is there. And since the most important thing, garbage collection, which must be provided is the garbage, freeing of wrongly allocated data structures, and the other garbage collector somehow is a second class garbage collector, which must harmonize with this garbage collection of failures. And garbage collection of failures, we have to maintain the stack discipline of the heap. So that means if you find garbage in between, okay, this is fine, we can squeeze it out, but then the remaining objects, the ordering of the remaining objects better should not be touched. Yeah. And then also the thing is, when you kind of throw away things, you do not only have to adjust the references in the stack and in the relative the references inside the heap, but you also have to adjust the references in the trail, because this is another runtime system which points to some objects. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let's see how we would do that. So this means here it's the same heap, but now we have to preserve the ordering. I may kind of go back. So here this is the A, B, C, D. Here you see, once again, here we started also with A, B, C, D, and in the end, due to this, the ordering was kind of reversed. So the end, we ended up with D, C, A. And that is not, this kind of garbage collector, therefore, would not work for the, in an environment like the Vim. So that's this point. And so therefore, where are we? Sorry. Ah, here. So therefore, we could find out the memory location, the memory objects which are reachable. But then we have to copy it in a way such that the ordering is preserved. Yeah? And that means, and then we do the same thing, we have these forward addresses, and then we kind of correct the addresses and everything is fine. But the ordering must be preserved. And that means, in order to preserve the ordering, or one way to do it, at least actually I do not know how to do it else, otherwise, is kind of to go sequentially through the from space once all the reachable objects have been found, and kind of for each cell there, check is it reachable or not, and then copy. Therefore, this copying is proportional to the total amount of space of objects in the from space. We also have to look at the dead objects. This makes this garbage collection more expensive than the one for functional languages, where we did not have to inspect the dead ones. Yeah, actually, that's the whole message which I have here. Actually, I'm not so. One should kind of one might look into it whether more. Sophisticated algorithms have been provided for Prolog, but I guess they do the simple thing because they kind of stick to the assumption that there's much less garbage created on non-failing programs. Yes, please. Once again?
If you have a lot of loop references, or a lot of references for a lot of objects, the running around and the running through the from space doesn't contribute so much to the time.
You mean traversing the from space is not so much a problem? So it's difficult to say. So whether this is really a big overhead or not. In general, Prolog programs are extremely space inefficient. So in that sense, one has to have large heaps anyway. Otherwise one can't. This would be immediately be doomed. Yeah. Okay, so now, after this little deviation into this runtime methods of garbage collection, so perhaps one more thing. So in these lecture evaluations, there's always asked: is there kind of a connection to current research or so? And perhaps if one in lectures. I guess this lecture had very amazingly was well evaluated. So thank you very much. At least it seemed from these evaluations that you more or less like this lecture, which is always nice to see. But concerning current research, this garbage collection thing is a weak point in implementation of languages, in particular thinking in particular of OCaml. Why? So OCaml has this very fast garbage collector, and therefore is provides competitive implementations. So you can use it really as a real-world programming language, and you get very fast systems. And that's the reason why we use it extensively. So that's on the good side. But on the negative side is that garbage collection is becomes critical or not so easy if you have a concurrent implementation. And concurrency is kind of a key feature which you kind of, it's a luxury, you might say. Who needs concurrency? It's only, it's invented to torture students, kind of to introduce subtle bugs into software, so it's kind of, it's on the negative side. But that's not true. If you want to exploit kind of inhomogeneous and in particular modern hardware architectures, you kind of at some point you have to go to multi-threading, otherwise you will not be able to create speed up. And so if you have a functional language or any garbage collected language, you kind of have to provide a concurrent garbage collector, and that is in particular a concurrent memory management, which is not so easy. Because if you have, say, in the extreme, you have 20 threads and all of them allocate objects, then they kind of, and you have only a sequential memory management, then this means there's a conflict at every allocation of an object. And this is kind of bad because it sequentializes a lot of computation, which is in some sense unnecessary because the two threads are completely independent. They only allocate objects. Yeah, and that's kind of a nuisance. And also the collection, if the collection kind of enforces the whole system to halt, this is one thread kind of, or at some, then this is leads to bad effects. So that is kind of, and people are, that is the reason why OCaml has no concurrent implementation. And that is kind of, makes it, this is critical, I would say, from a practical point of view. So therefore, some groups have tried to provide concurrent implementations. Some success was posted recently, but I have not seen the concurrent implementation yet. So far there has not been any. So here in this case, and also for this garbage collection and to provide concurrent runtime systems, this is an important feature which one has to solve in order to provide a competitive language. A language, in the long run, a language which is not able to support concurrency will die, I would say. At least in as a mainstream language. So in that sense, there is so this is an area where things are should happen and where currently active research is been done. Then, having these three languages, we now kind of come. We have two topics left. One thing is, what do we have to do? We looked at C. What do we have to do for object-oriented languages? So this is the next topic. And if we are done with that, we will kind of take a brief look at concurrency also and how a concurrent runtime system in principle could be built. And I think we have still 3 weeks left. So I think the class, we will get cover pretty much of that. But for today, I thank you for your attention, and we meet again next week.